AstronomyCast, episode 661, saying goodbye to missions that ended. Welcome to AstronomyCast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. I'm Fraser Cain. I'm the publisher of Universe Today. I've been a space and astronomy journalist for over 20 years. With me is Dr. Pamela Gay, senior scientist for the Planetary Science Institute and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how are you doing?
I am doing well. It is solidly winter here, which means we have gone from the part of the year where I have to turn off the air conditioning to record to the part of the year where I have to turn off the heat to record. And what I've realized is there's a lot of thermodynamic suffering that takes place for this podcast.
Yeah, we're like at the end of a really nice stretch of weather, and it's about to get cold and snowy, and I am nervous because the only person who handles snow plowing on our mountain hill has decided he doesn't want to do it anymore. So I'm not really sure how we'll escape our house. Anyway, let's get on with the show. It's always sad to say goodbye, but when we send our robotic emissaries out into the cosmos, it's just a matter of time before they shut down. Today, we're going to say goodbye to a few missions which have reached the end of their lives, but they were very good robots. All right, let's talk about some robots that are about to just turn into chunks of metal.
Well, they were always just chunks of metal. They were just slightly more animated chunks of metal in the past.
Smarter metal.
Smarter metal, yes.
Yeah. More mobile metal, yeah.
So my favorite Mars mission, and I never thought I would have a favorite Mars mission. My favorite Mars mission, InSight, is estimated to cease to function in a meaningful way sometime this month as dust builds up on its solar panels, and they're trying to measure every last possible earthquake they can. But its time is coming, and it's a good time to look back on what has become one of the most creatively engineered midstream along the way mission that we have so far sent to Mars.
So now, I mean, Mars InSight is solar powered. So yes. Why is it coming to an end? The sun's still there.
The sun is still there. The problem is that dust has a habit of building up between the solar panel and the sun and limiting just how much sunlight is able to get to those photovoltaic cells and power the systems, including the heaters that are needed to keep it going over time.
But wait, NASA is aware of dust. Why didn't they think of a way to remove the dust from the spacecraft?
I know. This is the constant question.
And it is like half the comments that I get on my videos.
I know. And what I love is this is the first mission that has like gone out of its way to try and remove dust from its own solar panels. Mm-hmm. They scooped up a scoop full of sand and used it to essentially remove the dust from the solar panels. But they don't have a lot of electricity.
Yeah, that method, though, I just want to talk about that method. So what they figured out, like normally, right, the rovers have their solar panels dusted off by dust devils. But for some weird freak of Martian weather, the place where InSight went hasn't been getting visited by dust devils. And so they figure out this really clever way where they scoop regolith with the little shovel, they dump it on the solar panels, and the dirt collects up this electrostatically charged dust and drags a bunch of it off. And they dramatically extended the life of the rover using this technique that nobody knew it was even possible, which is wonderful.
And this is one of those things where they weren't able to keep going with all the instrumentation. But the thermal sensor they had decided long ago that it was not going to be cooperative anyways. And so as they prolonged the mission, they simply said, we're going to let that one go. Mm-hmm. So to go back to the beginning, this little spacecraft landed back in 2018. It had two primary instrumentation sets. It had the seismograph and it had the mole. And the mole's goal was to drive itself down through the dirt on the surface, embed itself a couple of meters under the ground along the way, measure the thermal properties, and allow us to finally know if all of our models for how the temperature varies as a function of depth on Mars are accurate or not. Mm-hmm. And what we learned was the dirt on Mars is more clay-like than we had anticipated. And the mole did not dig. They tried everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I have very clay soil where I am, and when it dries out, it is concrete. And obviously, you know, regolith on Mars has dried out.
And the way the mole was supposed to work is it was a long cylinder that had essentially a thumper, just like out of the movie Dune, embedded inside, and it would slowly rise up and then smash down. And the smash down was supposed to drive the entire thing downward through the soil. And it just kind of stayed in place. They tried pushing it down with that wonderful arm. It refused to go. So we didn't learn anything about the thermal profile, but the creative solutions, they just kept trying until senior review said, stop, just stop.
Right.
We're truly delightful. The other instrument was a seismograph that was designed to measure Mars quakes, and they weren't sure what they would detect when they built this instrument. They figured if nothing else, they would catch the waves of space rocks, asteroids, hitting the surface of Mars and sending shockwaves reverberating through the planet. And what they found instead was Mars is continuing to have quakes. It has over 1,000 kilometer across a molten core that is a lower density than had previously been estimated. And that lower density is responsible for completely different thermodynamics than what had been predicted, allowing it to continue to have this molten core far longer than we had thought possible. Its surface crust is thinner than we thought. And we learned all of this because the planet periodically just has Mars quakes.
Yeah.
And we've been measuring them, and a bunch of them are located with the same geographic region. And so this world is a whole lot more interesting than we had thought. And we now need more seismographs, please.
Everywhere. Seismographs everywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, I facetiously asked the question about the Mars dust, but the answer is fairly simple. The spacecraft was designed for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And so they gave it this solar power capacity for 1 year, and it ended up lasting 4 years, way beyond what it was expected to. And could there be a system, some kind of mechanism that dusts or blows or wipes or cleans or electrostatically charges or scrapes dust off? Maybe. But each one of these devices adds to the weight, adds to the budget. And how they were given a set budget to work with, and they designed all of their science goals within that set budget, and they launched their mission. So, but on that note, actually, NASA is developing a really interesting sort of coating that they can put on everything that is clear, that is electrostatically charged, so that you can, or can be electrostatically charged, so you can actually run a current through it and repel things like the dust. Because like the stuff on Mars, it's like, imagine, like, you know, when you open up a package and you get that the little styrofoam.
The little white beads.
Yeah, the little styrofoam beads that just cling to everything. You try to wipe them off, and now they're all in your hands, and then you wipe them against something, and now they're all over that, right? Like, it's the electricity that's holding them. Anyway, so they've developed this new coating, and they've actually, they're testing it on the International Space Station right now. It's actually on the exterior. They have a bunch of experiments on the exterior of the station, and they will... if this works, then they can apply it to solar panels, to camera systems, to science instruments, to anything. And so just like by default, any new rover will be equipped with this coating. And then all of these surfaces will, they can run charge through them whenever they want to try and repel the stuff. So my point is like NASA's aware that there's dust and they've thought of ideas and they've had to reject all of them. And if you were in their meetings, you would have too. All right, we're going to talk about another mission that we're going to say goodbye to in a second, but it's time for another break.
And now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. The holidays are a hard time of year for a whole lot of people. And I know I'm super grateful for all the friends that carry me from Friendsgiving in November to the first waffles of January 1. But the people I have in my life now weren't always there. If you're struggling with the holidays, you, like me, can get professional help navigating not just this season, but also life in general from the folks at BetterHelp. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be easier. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/astronomy. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/astronomy.
And we're back. All right, what mission do you want to say goodbye to next?
So the Sophia Airborne Observatory, I think, is one that will eventually deserve its entire own show. But they only did its last flight in September of this year, 2022. And we're still waiting for all of its, well, latest round of data to get its first round of processing. So that highlights episode will have to come in the future. But for now, we have to say goodbye.
To what was Sophia?
So Sophia is the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. It's a modified 747 that has a over 2 meter telescope just kind of hanging out in the back with a door that they can open and point the telescope out, allowing them to, as they fly through up to 10 hours worth of night, allow them to observe the infrared sky in colors that we can't see even from our highest mountains, because they're able with the aircraft to get up above the worst of the water. Sophia flies up at 41,000 feet. So this is higher than your standard 747 on a consumer flight. And this specially designed observatory, it had vibration compensators. It had some of the coolest technology, literally, because it's infrared, you have to have cool technology of our time, allowing it to do everything from, I think one of the most surprising, and we covered this earlier, discoveries was they directly measured water in the regolith, being able to see that it was in places that it hadn't been anticipated previously. They were able to see helium hydride, which was a molecule that it was expected that it existed in the early universe, but we hadn't seen it prior to Sophia spotting it in a planetary nebula. This is one of the few molecules that helium is willing to be a part of, where basically a proton, a rogue hydrogen core, is able to share an electron with a helium atom. Over and over, this telescope allowed us to see wavelengths that otherwise required a spacecraft, but using instrumentation that got to be brought home at the end of the flight and modified and improved and constantly changed as our technology changed. And it was this fabulous hybrid between a ground-based facility with all of its atmospheric limitations and a space-based observatory with all of its lack of modification limitations.
So why are they shutting this down? I mean, it's not like its solar panels are getting covered with dust.
Yeah, this is the great question. It basically comes down to NASA only has so much money to run all of the observatories at any given moment. And JWST is the great sink of infrared funding right now. So with JWST fully functional, the argument was made that we don't need a 2.5 meter telescope pointing out the side of an aircraft when we have this significantly larger telescope sitting out at L2. And like
James Webb completely overlaps the capability of SOFIA, except that SOFIA can look at the moon. JWST can't look at the moon. But apart from that, and JWST could make the observations that SOFIA might make in an evening's, you know, in one flight, it could probably make that in a fraction of the time. It's more powerful. It's out in space.
Yes. But SOFIA lets you continue to innovate and test new technologies.
Right. And that is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to be able to experiment. And I've brought this up before. I am very much a fan of design and test, and just keep moving with incremental design. JWST, SLS, these are all, it works or it doesn't. Kind of all or nothing. And
Well, that's
like
the programmer in you, though, right? Like that process of iterative development and design is baked right into creating something that, that is complicated. And I 100% agree with you. I mean, there is another track where this stuff gets built and designed and tested, and that's balloons. So NASA still has a very vibrant balloon astronomy pathway. We actually just did an article on Universe Today about all of the cool balloon missions coming up in the next 10 years. So they're putting a lot of investment into developing new instruments, putting them on balloons, flying them at high altitude, and they can go way higher than SOFIA can, testing out to see whether they work, iterate, and then these things start to show up on spacecraft down the road. So I do think that there is another pathway. And so I guess that's probably it, is that in terms of pure productivity, SOFIA just doesn't hold a candle to JWST. You are burning jet fuel. You are contributing to climate emissions. You are, right, there are downsides of running a 747 for 15 hours. And then all the other ongoing expenses. So it just sounds like somebody just said, well, I think it's time to shut this thing down. And it is unfortunate because it's a wonderful, glorious instrument. And such a great idea and has produced so many wonderful findings. And yet it's just like the landscape has changed.
I do wish that they allowed it to stay commissioned, kind of like old Ironsides in Boston, one of the old tall ships stayed commissioned, where no one expects old Ironsides to sail out into battle anymore. But to have it to continue doing its teacher programs and to still be there if it's ever needed to fly once again.
if there's an asteroid passing in between the Earth and the Moon, and JWST, you just can't watch it, and then you can get Bruce Willis to fly SOFIA. Yeah. All right. What else would you like to say goodbye to?
So Voyager is shutting down.
No, don't say it. Voyager's fine. It'll live forever.
Voyager will live forever. This is entirely true.
In that the physical atoms will exist in some kind of coherent form for a few billion years, sure.
And come back. I'm trying to figure out how to make
a good
You're
trying to make a Star Trek reference? It'll find an alien intelligence, merge consciousness, return to Earth, and search for whales? No, wait. Now I'm starting to blend my sci-fi references. All right. But tell us about what is the state of the Voyagers? Because I feel like I've been bracing for impact for the loss of the Voyagers for about a decade now.
So Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are thought to have finally actually this time for have left our solar system's sun interacting environment and are on their way beyond it. Now, they're still within the confines of the Oort cloud. Our solar system really feels like it goes on forever, but they have exited the area that is defined by the sun's influence, and they are now able to experience the cosmic rays at the higher level, to experience the interstellar conditions better, and they were sending data back, and they continue to try to send data back, but it reached the point where they did have to turn off more instruments. And I think what was more of a, it's time to start to say goodbye than just shutting down more instruments, because they've been doing that on a regular basis pretty much as long as we've been alive.
Yes.
The real thing was Edward Stone, the project scientist, retired after 50 years.
Yeah.
And right now, what we're seeing isn't so much in planetary science the retirement of the Apollo era folks, because that's rocketry. Yes, we have a few of them. Harrison Schmitt still attends meetings. There is no greater way to confuse the speaker than to start your question with Harrison Schmitt, Apollo program. That is what causes speakers to tremble.
Yeah, Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
Apollo?
Well, he doesn't attend conferences and ask early career researchers questions the same way.
Right. Yeah. In the way that Dr. Harrison Schmitt does. Yeah.
But Edward Stone, he was part of this young group of researchers that didn't all even have advanced degrees as they were planning out exploration of our solar system. A lot of these people, they were basically making up what mission planning looked like as they went, because this was the first massive solar system exploration program we had had. And it was put together on basically lack of computers to plan out the orbits.
Yeah, I mean, think about the gravitational slingshot maneuvers they had to do to go past four planets by hand.
Slide rule.
I mean, they must have used computers to some extent, but still, it was an astonishing piece of work to do that.
And so now we're starting to lose that first generation of real planetary scientists who planned out these missions and were there from day zero to see the exploration of the outer solar system to, well, they missed Pluto the first round, but hey, that's what got us New Horizons. But the understanding that we got of Uranus and Neptune, Saturn and Jupiter, seeing Io's volcanism, the icy cracks of Europa for the first time, Titan's haze layers. We didn't understand prior to Voyager that all these moons of other worlds were worlds in their own right. And today we continue to see, I don't think kids are upset about Pluto and the definition of planet any longer, but planetary scientists really, really are.
Right, and right.
The number of people that want to classify all the major satellites as planets in their own right is not trivial. And that fight was basically started by the Voyager missions. And I don't know what will end the fight, but...
Yeah. But it is different. Like, when you think about the Voyagers, they've been shutting those instruments down one by one. And I think it's like when you care for somebody in your family, someone who is getting older, and you're sort of seeing this constant decline, and it's happening in real time for you, as opposed to an accidental loss. The feelings of grief are different, and it definitely feels very similar to me. Obviously, just a robot, but you're like, oh, it doesn't have, now it only has this many watts. Oh, it doesn't have the power to run that anymore. And that the last thing that we'll hear, like the last instrument to shut down, will be its ability to transmit home.
Communicate.
Yeah. And it'll all just be from declining power. Like all of the, like if you could replace its nuclear battery, it would be back up and operational. Probably. I mean, who knows how much damage is happening, but you could then send it to another planet and have it observe some more. But obviously there's no more other places for it to see. There's no interesting places for it to pass in the future. It's just going to run out of power and go silent and then drift in the Milky Way for another few billion years until cosmic radiation and space dust grind it away to nothing.
And it's estimated they will live to the 2030s, and beyond that, they just won't have the power to go on.
Yeah, we're within a decade of saying goodbye to them. All right. Well, we've reached the end of our show. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Fraser. And thank you to all of you out there who make this show possible through your patronage at patreon.com/astronomycast. And we are starting with this episode to put out a ad-free version just for our Patreon community. So go check that out. Join us. And this week, I would like to thank in particular Smensky, Cami Resian, Sean Martz, The Mysterious Mark, Glenn McDavid, Dwight Ilk, James Roger, Gabriel Galfin, Paul L. Hayden, Karthik Vekatraman, G4184, Benjamin Davies, Planetar, Stephen Coffey, The Lonely Sand Person, Andrew Stevenson, Brian Kilby, Nyla, Arctic Fox, Bart Flaherty, The Air Major, Sam Brooks and his mom, John Osleff, Dean, Nate Detweiler, John Drake, Corrine Dumptruck, Lou Zealand, Jordan Truner, Lee Harbour, Jason Kardukas, Ron Thorson, Paul Esposito, Arthur Latzhall, Frank Stewart, Ganesh Swaminathan, Bob Zatsky, Tim Garish, Ruben McCarthy, Robert Hundel, Kim Barron, Time Lord Iroh, Daniel Donaldson, Ian Abdellah, and Jeff McDonald. And if you want me to pronounce your name closer to true, please include a pronunciation guide. Otherwise, I'm just going to make it up.
All right. Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you all so much.
Astronomy Cast is a joint product of Universe Today and the Planetary Science Institute. Astronomy Cast is released under a Creative Commons attribution license. So love it, share it, and remix it. But please credit it to our hosts, Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can get more information on today's show topic on our website, astronomycast.com. This episode was brought to you thanks to our generous patrons on Patreon. If you want to help keep this show going, please consider joining our community at patreon.com/astronomycast. Not only do you help us pay our producers a fair wage, you will also get special access to content right in your inbox and invites to online events. We are so grateful to all of you who have joined our Patreon community already. Anyways, keep looking up. This has been Astronomy Cast.